There you go. What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast. Day two of the Sports Medicine Update from Memorial Hermann. We have the all-star, Dr. David Crumbie, the one that everybody rushed in to see. Stayed up all night preparing this presentation.
I did, literally.
Probably.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. And so it took us about 10 minutes to get from the auditorium over to here to interview him because he's so popular. We've got questions for him. And actually, Jeff, you're going to have to scoot up a little bit so people can see you. Oh. When you talk into the mic, you actually see how close I am. Didn't talk like that close. So they had a question for Crumbie, and so instead of just saying no, you can't ask him, I said, hey, let's let everybody benefit. So, Dr. Crumbie, I'm pleased to have you working so close with us that you're our surgeon. I really love the relationship we have and that I can text you, and ask you questions, call you, come see surgery. So, you know, I thank you for that. Bob, I thank you for all the work that you've done, connecting all of us.
My pleasure.
Dr. Crumbie. So, Memorial Hermann's done a great job in putting on this workshop as well. So without much further ado, Dr. Crumbie was talking about ACL re-tears and what do we do to prevent them, why do they happen, and so let's go ahead and start with Jeff, your question. I don't know who you are.
I'm Mark Moffitt.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we got Jeff and Mark, right out of both of you on Fort Bend?
Yes, yep. Sir.
All right, so let's start off with your question, Dr. Crumbie.
All right. I'm starting to see an instance of, like, professional athletes. They're going in and getting their surgeries, like, within 2 hours after they get injured. Does that have that much of an impact on the return to play afterwards? Like, I know normally we want to do some prehab in order to reduce the swelling before we go in, maybe reduce that. But with taking them in so early, are we avoiding some of the swelling and some of the atrophy that you might get normally with a delayed surgery?
Well, I think certainly the being more aggressive with the timing of surgeries such as ACL reconstructions in regards from right after the injury, I think that's more on the fringe versus what's more the mainstream, or I wouldn't call it necessarily standard of care. I think you have to pay attention to, you know, what's going on with the athlete. You know, there are some factors that force our hand, such as, you know, big meniscus tears or locked knee and what have you, that kind of force our hand in regards to, okay, hey, we have to address this sooner. Optimally, though, you want the knee to be more in a state of normalcy. You want it to look like the other side. And typically, it doesn't take 14 days, but usually it takes days to 1, maybe 2 weeks to kind of get the athlete there. Now, certainly with the professional guys, you have 3 therapists living with them 24, you know, hours. You have unlimited resources in regards to getting them out of that inflammatory phase a lot sooner. But typically, with the ACL injury, you want them out of the inflammatory phase of injury. So typically that's days to a week, maybe two. Probably with more normal people like everyone sitting here, yeah, it's maybe 2, maybe 3. Certainly with some of the, you know, J.J. Watts of the world and what have you, or, you know, Adrian Peterson and some of those guys, you know, you're talking about the 0.00001 percentile of the population and unlimited resources on top of that. Doesn't probably matter what you do. Okay. You know, in that sense. But certainly I think the key is just kind of the prehab approach, getting quad reactivated. I think you can be as aggressive as you can be after an injury with that, and also pass a range of motion. But usually just the logistics of how you get an athlete such as on the high school level to someone like myself and going through, you know, what you guys do, obviously on the front lines, you know, it takes a couple of days usually, but the time you get – because resources aren't just available, you also have, you know, maybe a day or two sometimes to get an MRI. By the time you get to here, as easily can be, you know, days to a week even. Mm-hmm. So I do think we're moving in that direction as far as being aggressive, but I think we always have to have a pause with respect to kind of how aggressive we are, whether it be prior to surgery, with getting surgery, or how we get patients or athletes back to playing. Again, I think the finish line has to change, you know, after surgery for sure.
Okay. I think one thing off that you touched on was the mental aspect of it. Not everybody's ready for it. Say, you know, obviously your mid-shaft tibia is at a right angle. That's one thing. They know I got to fix that, but not a lot of guys are mentally ready to go. You got to fix it. We're going to do it now. Okay, they've already shut down. So yeah. Some of them aren't ready, you know, to handle those requirements and stresses.
And more to your point, athletes who are kind of shut down. Again, first time the body's failed them. What's going on? I don't know what's happening. That shock usually prohibits them from being involved in prehab activity. So you see delays in quad recruitment. You see delays in ranges of motion that have and what have you. So, you know, and I think that – I know, yeah. And more to Bubba's point, I think the psychiatric aspect of it or the psych aspect of this impacts every decision, including not just timing of surgery, but also graft selection. There's going to be some grafts that are hard to get over. If you shut down and you get a bone to the bone, you know, like everyone's hit their knee on a coffee table. You know, right. Limped around for a week or two. Well, that's a hammer, you know. So I think it impacts every step on how we get athletes back on the field, and we have to identify those factors a lot more aggressively and intervene a lot earlier. And I think, you know, as far as when and how and what is one question, but certainly more of that will impact the patient, you know, more directly than anything else that we might do.
And from the high school standpoint, we all know our athletes, and there's always that one that gets hurt and go, oh, they're never coming back because they don't want to do anything. You know, and that kid's not going into the OR quick unless they're required to go.
Yeah, they just don't have the mental state that Adrian Peterson or J.J. Hall would have.
Right.
You could put duct tape on that guy. That guy is good.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So on that same thing, I used to kind of think, why do all these doctors keep telling me about this type of graft or this type of graft? And I was like, I'm never going to be the one making that decision. Why do they even concern me?
You are one of those making that decision.
Right. And that's the thing now, as you're talking about the psychological factors, is now if me and Dr. Crumby are on the same page, just saying, hey, you know, I think these two grafts are the best choice, and this one's probably going to be best for you, then he's telling them, I'm telling them. And so then they're like, oh, okay, you know, I can get behind this. I can believe in this. I really believe what he's saying, rather than just like, I don't know, just whatever the doctor says. And so, like, it just, I don't know. I've always said I'm a little slow at realizing things. And so I think that it is important for me as an athletic trainer to understand which is going to be best for that kid. And like you said, because I'm going to interact with that kid more for the psychological factor and saying, you know, this is what Crumby is going to feel is best. And, you know, I think he really knows what he's doing. So it's important for us as athletic trainers to know what the doctor's saying. Know why they're saying.
And I can take it a step further and say it's the same reason why you need to understand the surgical procedure. You see them 5, 6, 7 days a week, depending. He sees them a couple times. You're answering those questions every day. You got to know what it is. You've got to understand, well, you know, within reason, they're going to do X, Y, and Z. Okay. And he's going to go see him and go, well, within reason, we're going to do X, Y, and Z. And now again, hey, okay. There is something to what they're saying. They are on the same page. You know, they're going to – how many times they ask you, well, should I do this graft or how do they do the surgery? What does this mean? You're that first line of defense. You're the shell answer man for that. You've got to know that. That's been my argument for years. No, I can't go into his OR and do the surgery. I could probably walk somebody through it. I've seen enough, okay? But I'm not going to go in and do it, but I can tell you what's going to be done, and that's important.
And, you know, and everybody at this table knows this, you know, sports medicine is not about necessarily just the athlete and just the coach or the parent or the whatever and the surgeon or team doc or whatever else. You know, sports medicine at its core is about relationships and the support of that. And, you know, and in that light, you know, it's about communication, obviously. Certainly, as Bubba knows, and you guys know too, if you've been in my clinic and Jeremy's been there too, you know, the most time I spend with someone is the 45 minutes we talk about what you got, what we got to do to get you better, et cetera. Outside of that, it's usually kind of, hey, bye, you know, kind of stuff. So I lean heavily on athletic trainers. There's two jobs I could never have, you know, if this thing doesn't work out and I got to find something else, you know. One is athletic trainer, number one. Two is a nurse.
Because they got to deal with you.
Exactly. You know, so I lean heavily on that relationship, and I think that also, you know, impacts how we take care of athletes, you know. So, you know your athlete better than me, and you know that kid and how they're going to respond. And sometimes I even just flat out ask, you know, what's up with this guy and that type of deal, you know, as far as that's concerned. So, you know, when it comes to graft selection and all that kind of stuff, I think that for as a surgeon standpoint, a team doc, I don't have just one. You know, and you see me talk, you know, it's kind of, hey, we figure it out together. We lay all the options out. We kind of talk about the factors I think do influence. But certainly I think, you know, if you're going to do this for a living, and you know, and I think that this is something that you have to customize to the situation. There's a lot of factors that are in that room and not in that room, you know, that we need to anticipate as well as bring to the table in regards to graph selection. There's a lot of controversy about what's what and that type of thing. I think there's definitely some movement in regards to kind of what's coming more popular with allografts, and usually that's from a standpoint of, you know, I don't do this very often. The average is, you know, for average orthopedic surgeon is probably, you know, one a month maybe, you know, and versus someone that's doing it, you know, fairly, you know, commonly, you know, I probably do it a little bit more than that. You know? Yeah. So I think for me, my comfort level with whatever graft that we do, I think, is important. I think you have to customize that to the athlete, and a lot of factors go into that, just not, you know, female, male, size, you know, propensity for the next level of competition goes into it, position, you know, what do we have on the line here, and et cetera. So, you know, I think there's a lot of factors, and, you know, we can get into a bunch of that. That's a talk in itself, basically. But, you know, I think that on the surgical side, you got to be willing to customize that choice to the athlete versus making the athlete choose only one route.
So going specifically athletic trainers, I mean, obviously you talked about tunnel location. Y'all are moving more towards anatomical, which, again, helps me be on the same page, but I'm not going to make that choice. But you did say that prehab and that functional physical therapy is something that they need to do, which is, that is exactly what we should be doing as athletic trainers, be doing prehab and functional physical therapy. So real quick, what are your favorite or what are your recommended prehab exercises?
Well, there's a lot of things you can get real complex and, for lack of a better term, sexy with, you know, as far as exercises are concerned. I think the two things that you got to do is quad sets, isometric quad sets. You want to get the all four muscles firing, and not just firing, but at the same time. So reactivation of the quad is going to be key, and that helps you get terminal extension as well as passive flexion. And a part of the way that you would do an anatomic reconstruction, if you're going to go from inside out instead of outside in, is getting the flexion. You can't really do the surgery unless you get the flexion. So for me, one of my criteria before, you know, saying, hey, we're ready to go whenever you want it, is, you know, getting that 120, 130 degree range actively. You know, I probably can get them to 140 with them, you know, under anesthesia. So those two things, I think, are the key. You can get into, you know, hip external rotation, you know, strengthening and leg lifts and et cetera. But if you don't have those two components, then it doesn't really matter to me.
All right. So it's good prehab stuff there. And then one of the things that you showed me in the clinic, I think it was at the beginning of this football season, is to put your hand underneath their heel when they're doing their quad set, because they tend to tighten up the hamstring, which is the opposite of what we're trying to do, right?
The brain is very smart. It's going to adapt. So when it figures out that, you know, by doing this exercise, one, I have to work. Two, there's a cheaper, easier way of doing it, doing the exercise that makes me feel like I'm doing a quad set. You're right. You're going to fire glutes. You're going to fire hamstrings. So a way to kind of make sure that we're firing the quad and getting it back up and going, because literally after an injury such as this and extending the joint, it's out on the beach. So it doesn't want to come off the beach. So the way that you do it is that you have something, you have the foot slightly elevated off of the surface that you're doing the exercise on. But if you feel the heel touching, that automatically means that, hey, you're not firing quad. You're firing, to get the heel to touch, you're actually having to fire the posterior chain. So the hamstrings and the glutes fire would actually put your knee into flexion. So that's a good way to kind of say, hey, this is what I'm doing. I'm doing a quality set. Now there's, you know, stimulators and that type of thing that can give you some biofeedback to kind of make sure that you're firing correctly, and those are helpful. A lot of times it can be financially limiting kind of step for us sometimes. So, you know, those are the cheap, dirty ways necessarily that we can kind of get active quad reactivation, terminal extension, and then heel slides would be another way to kind of get flexion. I don't like using bike to get range of motion. I like to use bike to keep it. So that's another way that we can kind of do that. So I like to use active, because that pretty protects the, you know, the patient. So if they really feel a lot of resistance, a lot of pain at 30 degrees, that tells me a lot. We may be dealing with something blocking range of motion versus something that's, you know, that we're trying to just push through and end up tearing up something more.
And just on that real quick, there's sometimes where I tell the kids, you know, let's get you on the bike and get you moving, but it may be for like a quad strain or bruise. Using the bike for or increasing the range of motion, is that okay there, or are you talking about just for ACL, try not to use it, or in general?
I think it's good to have an armamentarium where we're warming up the soft tissues, and I think that's what you're alluding to in those other type of injuries. I think that's fine, but I don't want you to put an athlete on a bike and say, hey, you know,
drop the seat and crank on them.
Yeah, we're going to crank on this and make your knee bend is more of the point. But as far as warming up the soft tissues, it's a great exercise.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I try to do is just let's get some motion going. We get
warmed up. Can we go up to the bike?
You've got to have 110 degrees of flexion to get on a bike anyway. And so if you can get on the bike, the odds are pretty good unless you've got something bad going on. We're not going to lose that flexion. But we've still got to be on the table some working on that remainder of that flexion. Because I'm not going to drop the seat to go, okay, you're 110, we can pedal a little bit, let me drop it and get you some more because we're doing something bad there. But we can maintain that. And typically as they get going and warm, we'll get more flexion. And I think I may have come up with a cheap way for biofeedback. I'll tell you later. So,
well, in regards to the bike, I was thinking more of the full extension where you bring the seat up to extend. During getting them to extend more.
Right.
That's what I always like to use the bike for, kind of, instead of more of the flexion.
Right. Well, you should have a high seat anyway. The bottom stroke of your pedal should be at about 10 degrees knee flexion. Right. You know, but again, you should, we can argue this all day long, you know, and talk about the pros and the cons. But
well, I like the static approach a little bit better. It's more controlled versus kind of, there's an arc of the range of motion that you're going to go through where you're going to get that, you know, strain for extension. Then it's going to be some relaxation. So that kind of herky-jerky kind of approach I tend to not like as much as a controlled, sustained contraction, where I think that's going to be more controlled, and particularly in the situation where we're either preparing for surgery or we're rehabbing from surgery. I think that's probably a little bit better approach than kind of, you know, doing it in a less controlled fashion.
One of the things you said in your lecture, and I think you actually said at the beginning here, is what's the finish line? What's the goal? And that's something we have to look at is, you know, is this kid planning to play in college? Is this kid planning, you know, possibly going to play professional? Or are they going to graduate from high school next year and go work in the chemical plants? And so we do need to look at the goal, and it's not just return them to play, but improve their productivity and their functionality long term.
I definitely feel like we're moving away from just say, hey, you got this, so we need to do this. However, I would say that if you're south of 30 years old, I think that it's a preventative surgery, you know, because we know that with extra motion in the knee, and that age group is more apt to do high-risk activities, whether it's on the field or not, that you're going to have potential for more cartilage injury. And I think that will have a negative impact on the knee later on, long term. So if you're north of 30, I do think that all those factors come into play. You know, certainly there's, you know, occasionally I'll see someone that, you know, one patient comes to mind that was playing football, had a horrific knee injury, had basically a knee dislocation, and end up not reconstructing him, you know, because he had a vascular injury. So there's all sorts of considerations with, you know, someone that has a bad knee injury, such as an ACL or even worse, that you have to put on the table and assess. It's just not purely, oh, we got this, you know. And I could have made his knee stable, but there's no need for a stable knee if you don't have a leg.
Yeah.
So I think all those factors come into play, and I think you have to be cognizant of what's best for the athlete, and that's, you know, and that's what you're alluding to. I'm just pretty aggressive with young people with ACLs and getting them a stable knee, irrespective of what their plan is. And we know that, you know,
chondral sparing.
Your plan at 15 may not be the same plan at 16. So a lot of times, you know, for that we have to just consider everything like you're alluding to. And I think that also plays a significant role.
Well, regarding that, what about someone? I had an athlete that year before I even got there, tore his ACL. It wasn't noticed. He never went to the doctor to go get it checked out. Year later, he come back, almost a full year later, he comes back to me complaining that his knee's still not 100% where it used to be, but it looks like he's obviously adapted to being able to walk perfectly fine and even run some without his ACL. Now, they went ahead and took him in and did an ACL reconstruction on him. Is there any potential long-term factors in the fact that his body and knee had actually adapted to the fact that he didn't have one at that point? And in reference, he's a soccer player, so a lot of change of direction. And
quick story. Yeah. When I came back to Houston, one of the first athletes that I took care of was a guy that hurt his knee as a sophomore. He was a senior. Now, he was able to come back and play the junior and the senior year, and kind of the same story. It's like, yeah, you know, this knee doesn't feel quite the same since I heard it back when I was a sophomore. Yeah, never sure. Kind of got looked at and et cetera, mm-hmm. to the extent where the coaches wouldn't run him but one side to the right. Wouldn't run him to the left where he may have to cut off the left. He may have to cut or pivot off the left foot, and that was the knee.
Yeah, our guy went from striker to defender because he couldn't, you know, cut as much to get to the goal.
So, and that was what my point was in the lecture. There are some athletes that can get back to return to play, and more the point of we have to change the finish line. You know, it's just not over just getting back on the field, because there is a certain percentage out there that have the other factors, you know, positively impacting the function of the knee, such as neuromuscular firing and what have you, that can control the knee in space.
Okay.
At least enough to be able to get back on the field. Yeah, now, the question is, how productive are you?
Yeah.
And again, that's another issue with changing the finish line. So for me, and I look at this, I go, yeah, certainly ruptures is a horrific thing, and no one wants to have surgery again, and et cetera, et cetera. I got that. And I know that everybody wants to get back in 2 weeks from ACL surgery. I got it. Mm-hmm. Okay. I think ultimately, though, when we're looking at revisions, why they happen, how do we prevent them, whether it be primaries or revisions, I think to comprehensively look at how well we're doing, it can't just be return to play. I think that's a part of it, and that's just only the way we look at it now. Mm-hmm. I think we have to maybe even accept a re-rupture, because ultimately if we put graft tissue where the ACL was, obviously it's not a graft. Or I'm sorry, obviously it's not an ACL. It's a graft. So when it experiences ACL forces, then it may have a higher re-rupture rate. That's not a reason for me in my mind to abandon the anatomic technique and go back to a transtibial technique, because it's not experiencing forces in that position the same as if you do it anatomically to avoid re-ruptures necessarily. Because I feel like, and I certainly see it in my practice, where I see more cartilage injury, whether it be articular surfaces, I see more meniscus injury or re-injury, such as medial meniscus in particular. And certainly those type of observations are backed up by what's available in the literature in regards to the differences between those two approaches for this injury. So, again, I think that the finish line has to change so that we can comprehensively look at what we're doing and then assess, hey, this is better or worse or what have you. But I think as a culture, we have to accept that, hey, this is changing a lot. You know, this is changing how we look at this, and it has to get away. I think we're doing a good job, or initially starting, where we get away from time-based return to play versus a functional-based return to play. You know, I think we're going to find that, you know, 6 months to 9 months isn't kind of realistic anymore. I think it's more closer to 9 months to a year, no matter what graph you use, you know. And I think we have to get patients to accept that, because ultimately what we really want to do is not necessarily get them on the field. It's more about we want to prevent them from having cartilage re-injury.
I want to back up for just a second, because you were talking about Jeremy, about knowing what he likes to do, graft choice and all that. I think it's also important and incumbent on us as athletic trainers to tell the doctor, this kid's going to push it. You know, he's going to do everything times five. And that determines what graft he uses and also what words he uses in the office. You know, this kid isn't going to do anything. He's going to lay on the couch. You know, he's going to show up once a week. That changes everything, too. And I feel it's important. He knows that. You've got to have that conversation. But it also ties into what I spoke about, what he's talked about. It also changes those expectations at the end result. When am I going to be ready? It still boils down to how hard are you going to work? How well do you heal? You know, if you take the surgeon part out of it, where did we put the graft, la, 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 well, how hard are you going to work? My definition of hard work and your definition of hard work and the kid's definition of hard work are not the same. You know, and so I think it's important to know, hey, he's not showing up in the training room but once a week. Let him get on him. That's what he'll, you know, a good doctor is willing to do that. You've told him, the coach has told him, doesn't matter. When mama hears it when they go to that appointment, that's totally different.
And Jeremy would attest to that. I want to hear that, you know. And I was like, send me an email. And I put it in the chart. So when I see them, I go, hey, what are you doing? Well, what about this? You know, I confront them in that regards, because to me it's mining now until I give it back to you, you know.
Yeah.
There's a lot of homework, and I think the more you engage the athlete too, the better they're kind of having more of a role and, you know, a more significant role in kind of directing their own care. But they really have to drive the bus, you know, not me, certainly. I don't spend enough time with them. You can better drive the bus. You're more of a passenger, you know, but ultimately to get where they want to go, they have to, you know, get out of the passenger seat and get exactly and get in the driver's seat and run this thing. They should be beating you guys to the training room.
Yeah.
Right.
Go to the doctor and I'm like, what do you say? Oh, I don't know.
It's your knee.
Look, go to the doctor. If they don't answer your question, tell them, hey, I'm not going to pay you until you answer my question. Right? I'm the one that's right in the chat. I'm the one that's, you know, some kids now, they don't pay anything. But
I'm like, who's paying?
I can explain it to you in words you understand, because you're going to have to explain that to someone. You have to deal with it. And so what are some of the ways that I can better communicate that to my students, to, hey, make sure you understand what they tell you?
Well, I think for me, it's not about necessarily the scenario that you just presented, you know. And you see me with the student athletes, you know, and our student trainers, I'm sorry, in my clinic, and I always ask them at the end of that clinic, what's the most important thing you learned? It's not exam, it's not MRI, it's not any of those things that they may think is what I need to learn today. You know, my goal when I open the door is to have a porch conversation with whoever's in the room. And that you know, because I can get more information that I need to make, you know, better decisions. And I feel like the better I communicate, the better the patient or athlete is engaged. They have more of a propensity to have better outcomes, to be participating in what we're going to ask them to do and everything else. So more to, not necessarily to the scenario, but more to the point, is about communicating effectively. That's the most important thing, and that's ultimately what's most important, particularly in sports medicine, because we deal with so many diverse backgrounds and people involved in sports. That's one of the beautiful things about sports, is that it's not kind of segregated into this only one segment of the, you know, populace and what have you. You got everybody on the football field. You got everybody on the baseball field. You got everybody on the volleyball, soccer, what have you. You got everybody, you know. So you got to be able to connect. I think you got to be able to communicate. And a lot of that is not saying, well, I assessed your ACL and, you know, your Lachman test demonstrates that your anterior bundle and posterior lateral bundle is disrupted in the anterior cruciate ligament, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it's about, you know, again, having a porch conversation with somebody. You know, I'm from the South, so everything's kind of, you know.
So if I'm instructing my students, not to you, because, again, like I said, I think you're great. You do a great job of communicating, like you said, having a porch conversation. But the kids, they go to a different doctor. I say, what do you think? What is the best way for me to instruct them to communicate with a doctor?
It's their freaking body part. Pay attention and get answers.
Yeah.
Wow, don't come back and ask you, because you weren't in the room.
I've started sending my kids. We'll sit down. We're like, okay, you have a doctor's appointment tomorrow. We sit down after their rehab. What do you want to know? What do I want to know? And I've started sending all of my athletes with a list of questions for their doctor that are in basic terms that they can understand. And it's great, because the doctor now, some of the ones that I've gotten a good rapport with, have started sending back a written list with him that are all in answers that the patient can understand,
which are usually yes, no, we'll see.
Like, yeah, and a lot of times it's, can I start? They'll want to know, can I start running yet? Well, yes. Can I go past 90 on my lifting yet? No. And then I'll add in a few more that get a bit more details.
Right.
Like for the beginning ones, if they don't want to hear it from me, why is my hamstring hurting? Although usually I can explain that one to them with the type of graft. But it's just, the list is really helping my patients get the conversation, and so they know what's going on with their own knee.
Probably if the doctor just sat in the same room with them and texted back and forth, they would know what was going on, because that's usually how you have to communicate.
Except I can't text that fast.
You can try using emojis.
Yeah, exactly. We can get an ACL tear emoji.
Smile.
A hinged knee brace emoji.
Finger down.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe that's what I have to start doing. I actually text my daughter in the same room. She's sitting beside me. I go, how was your day? Yeah. And she's like, what is that? Tick, 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 tick. It's me pecking away.
It takes longer, but that's how you get her to respond.
Yeah.
I think one of the things he's touched on it. I didn't have a chance to touch on it yesterday, but it's important is outcomes. Everything now is outcome based. The way insurance is, if he has a failure, depending on why, he's dinged for that now. And so we've got to ensure that everything we have that athlete slash patient do is the right thing for them to do. And we can show, again, part of why we wanted to check, we can show they can meet these criteria that have research to them. So when we put them back to sport, we have no hesitation in putting them back to sport. Yeah, what's the re-rupture rate? What, 15%, something like that? We know there's a number out there that – you know, that you're going back to the same sport that put you on the operating table, so you're going back to that same risk. But at the same time, he sleeps well at night. I sleep well at night. You sleep well at night. The patient does. I'm ready to go. There's no doubt in the back of the mind, because there's a doubt in the back of the mind that Tampa scale on mine is telling you, no, they're not ready. You know, and he's getting that same report that says, we might need to intervene mentally on this one, or, you know, you need a kick in the butt. Let's go. You're telling me everything and showing me, not just telling me, you're showing me everything I need to see as well.
All right. I think I'm sure you got somewhere you're supposed to be, but that's probably – I think we got somebody else coming in next. Any other questions for Crombie?
I'm good.
All right. All right.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
If someone wants to get a hold of you, what's the best way to do that?
Everybody else calls my cell phone, but it may be slightly inappropriate here, but call you guys, you know, certainly they, you know, I'm available via email on the internet, or, you know, certainly call in the office, and, you know, you guys that have my cell phone, you know, guys will call me anytime.
Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely.
Yep. So, all right, very cool. Dr. David Crombie, our orthopedic surgeon there in Pasadena ISD. Great guy. If you're in the area, or if you're not, if you want to just fly in from a different part of the country.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks.